Hey everyone, welcome back to Manual Therapy Blog. I'm your host, Matt Thomason, as always, where we try to provide you with inspiration, education, and empowerment for as many things possible related to manual therapy. And today we're getting to speak with Tim Flynn. A lot of you probably have heard of Tim Flynn, especially in the recent years, for all of his work with the opioid epidemic and combating all the negative side effects of that, or negative effects of that, and especially what we can do as a profession to be the frontline care providers for musculoskeletal issues. Tim has certainly been very active within our profession otherwise, though, and he has been a past president of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. He's very active with a continuing education organization called Evidence in Motion, which is really more than just a continuing education organization, but he's also a practice owner of Colorado in Motion, which, as you might guess, is in Colorado. And he's also a faculty member with South College in their DPT curriculum program. So that's a little bit about Tim, and probably not nearly enough considering all the things that he's done. But we get to learn different things about his past, especially the fact that he is trained, you know, well-trained in a lot of manual therapy, traditional manual therapy ways. But over the years, and as time has evolved in terms of research and research findings, he states how his overall practice in terms of manual therapy has changed with that, and how he encourages other clinicians not to be afraid of that change. So we get to hear about that. We get to hear about a number of different things related to past, present, and future. All the things are, you know, very fascinating, very entertaining to listen to for Tim. He's such a great speaker. So if you haven't had a chance, you know, by all means, please listen in here. But you can certainly also Google his name or look him up on YouTube. He has several great talks, especially in regards to the opioid issue. So anyway, I hope you appreciate and enjoy what you get to listen to here. If you are interested in anything else related to Tim Flynn or what he's up to, by all means, please also look down at the links of interest that we have at the bottom of the page, the webpage for this conversation. And if you have any questions, comments, or anything else regarding this, please leave us a comment on the webpage or iTunes or anything else for that matter, Twitter, Facebook, all things great. So hope you enjoy it, and hope you enjoy getting to listen to Tim Flynn. Tim, thanks for joining us. How are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent. Appreciate being on the show.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for joining us. Tim, we usually start off just by asking people that we get to talk to if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of, you know, where you grew up, what life was like for you before you actually got into PT.
Oh, wow. That takes me back a long time since you're interviewing old folks, but I'll make it really quick. You know, I grew up in a small town in South Central South Dakota, youngest of five, and, you know, kind of one of those, I guess, existence where, you know, you'd play kick the can and spend most of your nights out and about getting into trouble, but probably most of the people realized what you're getting into trouble and look the other way. Anyway, long story short, I was fortunate to go to get out of a small town. Not that I, you know, wanted to leave necessarily, but from the perspective of I wanted a future that was perhaps different. So I went to Marquette, where I went to PT school. I was on an ROTC scholarship. So I kind of went to PT school in Milwaukee and spent the 4 years there before joining the military in Fort Sam Houston down in San Antonio, Texas. So my first early career as a PT was in San Antonio there, Brook Army Medical Center. And, you know, you always look back at how opportunities shape your future. I was fortunate enough to have just outstanding mentors that kind of rocked my world. I got in there and was like, wow, this is nothing that I learned in PT school. And the expectations of you knowing stuff were quite high. I mean, again, back then, just imaging and, you know, pharmaceutical, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory privileges. You had all this autonomy, which was just not necessarily the case back in the early 80s. 80s in most private sector places. So anyway, just learned a ton. And along the way, the military sent me back to grad school a couple times at Michigan State, where I was fortunate enough to work with a great mentor, Phil Greenman, who is an osteopathic physician and just a tremendous human being, and gave me opportunities to teach in the manual medicine series with them. And fast forward a bit with a few stops in El Paso, where I was in a medical center down there, and then went to grad school at Penn State and kinesiology, and was in the locomotion and gait lab there, Center for Locomotion Studies, which was really a different bend. At the time, I was really into manual therapy, and that took me into, you know, kind of this biomechanics world and a world of just movement, but more on a, you know, more of a smaller analysis level. And from that, learned to become a better researcher, and also learn things that, you know, I probably felt I was not interested. I always say I learned a whole lot about a little. And I was, at the time, I think I knew a lot about the propagation of waves down the human tibia, and whether or not that was related to stress fractures, which, by the way, it is not. So anyway, I kind of went down that pathway. But when I got out of Penn State, it was kind of interesting, because it's the 90s, mid to late 90s. And during the time in grad school, all of a sudden, this, you know, there's this movement happening on evidence-based practice. And, you know, I get out of my PhD program and just feel like I know nothing about our profession, because everything was being questioned, and, you know, what value do we have? And, you know, the guidelines are coming out saying, you know, basically most of what we do doesn't matter, except this little thing called spinal manipulation, which appeared to have some pretty good evidence behind it even back then in the treatment of low back pain. So at the same time, I'm kind of getting involved with the academy, the AAOMPT, and was fortunate to, you know, just meet a bunch of passionate people that cared. And, you know, that kind of took me, got my energy flowing again as I kind of got back into the kind of manual therapy community.
Oh, wow. So that's quite a bit, that background that you gave us there. It certainly sounds like you've traveled all over the country back and forth.
Yeah, in the military I did. I had quite a bit of, I was mainly in the States. So really, I went into the military to see the world and spent a lot of time in Texas. So San Antonio is a medical hub. So I was stationed there twice. So I think for a total of 9 years, and then 4 years in El Paso. So I spent a lot of time in Texas.
Okay, great. Yeah. And I was just thinking, as you were talking, one, you know, thank you for your service and all the time that you spent in the military for everybody. But how did you, if you can go back a little bit, how did you first become interested in physical therapy as a career?
Well, you know, I was, I guess, lucky in that I kind of figured out where I was going, you know, to school. And then I kind of looked literally in the catalog and said, you know, what sounds interesting? I was an active person. And I thought, physical therapy, that sounds interesting. And I really like that movie, The Roy Campanella Story, which, for those that recall, he was a catcher that, I think, from the Brooklyn Dodgers, and then when they moved to L.A., he actually was in a motor vehicle accident and suffered a spinal cord injury. And the story is a lot about his rehab, and his physical therapist is a key person in that. And looking back, I mean, his physical therapist is African American, which, you know, again, at the time and even now, you know, given the lack of diversity in our field, is pretty fascinating. And I need to pull out that movie, see if I can find it anymore. But anyway, that movie, actually, I thought, well, that's a cool job. This guy looks like he's a caring and motivating individual. So that's really kind of how it was. A bit lucky, I fell into the field. And back then it was a 4-year degree, and at Marquette you could get in straight away, which I was late and didn't, but I was able to transfer in my sophomore year.
Okay. Yeah. So what was the name of that movie?
The Roy Campanella Story.
Roy Campanella Story. Okay. Yeah. I've never heard of that. I'll have to check it out. So you were talking about your time, you know, starting out in San Antonio, and that you had a lot of key influential people in terms of your career, or at least career path or trajectory. How did that go in terms of getting started there? And, you know, did they challenge you just based on their expertise and you just looked up to them and wanted to grow and learn more that way? Or, because it certainly sounds like even back then it was a pretty unique environment, as much as it is now in the military, where you have certain privileges that we don't in the private sector.
Yeah, I think it was a combination of expectations that this is the standard. So it became really clear day one that, you know, whoa, my knowledge base in musculoskeletal medicine is very, very low compared to the people I'm around. So one of it was just this expectation. You were given... Yeah, I often say you're promoted above your pay grade. You were just expected to know that. But then you also were readily mentored when you didn't, you know, okay, here's what it is. And then you're expected to make sure you didn't ask again. So if you didn't, go study it and figure it out. So there was clearly a culture of learning. It was a teaching medical center. The Army Baylor physical therapy program was next door. And so, you know, their intern students at the time would be there. And of course, there I was actually younger than a lot of those because it was a master's program. And just, you know, it was a very good mentorship from them to me in many ways as well. And so there's just, again, a culture of learning and an expectation that you did it. And you know, you just came home, your brain would be fatigued, and you'd eat, and then you'd go back to, okay, I need to look this up because I need to know this tomorrow. Otherwise, I'm going to get grilled. So there was this, again, just that expectation of, you know, continue to grow.
Yeah. So who are some of your mentors at that time?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I look back and I had my boss, just a tremendous leader, no longer living, Colonel Sue Osborne, who was just a legend in the field, if you will, because she just, she had spent her career in lots of places and, you know, tours in Vietnam, and just had a perspective of expectations of what good physical therapists did and what their role was in the healthcare system. So she was a tremendous mentor and leader, and just a positive role model of what you wanted to be. I mean, Jim Swain, you know, taught me more about radiology than I think anyone. And I had some a friend named Jim Heater, again, who sat across from me and that would teach me literally every day. And I also had guys that were and gals that were running. So, you know, Nancy Henderson, and she would got me into running and would always be, again, teaching. You know, she was just a natural teacher. So there's always those types of things happening. So, lots of folks. And then really from the medical side, I mean, I still bring up a neurosurgeon, Dr. Jack Youngblood, who was just you know, you'd go on neuro rounds and surge rounds, and he was the classic, I mean, old school kind of in terms of expectations of what you knew. But I mean, the pecking order was, you know, the medical interns, you know, would be at the back, and then the first year residents moving up to fourth year residents. And then physical therapists and occupational therapists were in the front because we were actually professionals and practicing. And, you know, he would defer to us. And, you know, when it was talking about musculoskeletal screening and nerve root levels, et cetera, and like, you know, these guys know it, you guys got to know it. And it was just a very interesting, you know, looking back, interesting attitude of and collaborative nature of how that process worked. And you know, one of the things I remember, and the comment I'll make it sound a little better than it was, but basically, you know, he would tell therapists such as Flynn, I don't want to see any of your back pain patients unless there's urine come down their leg and I hear their foot slapping as they're coming down the hallway. I mean, he was one of those guys, you look back now and say, you know, surgery was for a neurological deficit. It was not designed for pain. Yeah. And he just knew that back then because, I mean, they would see failures and they understood what the role was for that. So, you know, you look back now, here we are nearly, you know, 35 years or actually not nearly, it is 35 years later. And, you know, and the how we've just harmed so many folks with needless and inappropriate surgery in the spine. I mean, way back then, you know, they knew that there was a role and that role was clearly not at the front end of a pain problem. It was a role to treat neurosurgery. Surgery was for the treatment of neurological deficits and dysfunction.
Yeah, very much so. And that's one of the things that is nice to get to speak with you about, because your passion and your study and all the different things that you've done for our profession related to surgeries that are not needed or even the opioid crisis. You know, I've seen you talk at conference and even a lot of videos that you've done for social media and otherwise. So just really thank you for, you know, what you're doing and trying to get a better word out there for our patients, really, not just for us as a profession.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that is clearly my passion. You know, you look at life and how it takes you in different ways and what your role should be at different points in your career. And I just really feel that, you know, now it really is translation of research. There was a time back in the early, late 90s, early 2000s, where we really did need a better research base for what we were doing. And do not hear me saying we don't need to continue to grow our research base. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to pathways of care, when it comes to when you have a musculoskeletal ache and pain, what is your best first pathway, that's well known now that, you know, PT first pathway, you know, reduces imaging, reduces surgery, reduces opioid use. So we now have data from a kind of a macro level to say, you know, what should be the appropriate pathway. Yes, we can continue to build our evidence, and we still aren't great at the management of the chronic pain, chronic back pain, etc. But we have a lot of evidence to say how we can reduce harming folks. Mm-hmm. And so the problem now is not that we don't have the evidence. The problem is that it's not being applied across our society. And so our, you know, I really feel a big role right now is to change pathways and to really get the word out to decision makers and really to individuals and patients that, you know, don't choose this pathway first because the likelihood of harm is really high. And I think that that's really where, you know, my voice has turned in these last few years.
Yeah, it's a good thing that it has. I could say that much. If I could go back a little bit and kind of keep asking you a couple of other things as we kind of go around and around here. But you said a bunch of early mentors that you had in your earlier part of your career, but you also mentioned another big one in terms of Phil Greenman of osteopathy fame. And I don't know if I would just say muscle energy, but functional technique, manipulation, everything related to it. How did you get into that Michigan State realm?
Yeah, that was back in when I was – I came about that through their – they had a manual medicine course series, which actually continues to this day. And actually another mentor named Steve Stratton, who was still practicing down in San Antonio. Steve was in the military at the time. And, boy, I ran into him, and he was just this guy that was doing all this manual therapy. He was known for, you know, just having great hands, you know, manipulation, muscle energy, these various techniques. And he basically said, well, if you're going to learn this, you got to go to Michigan State series. And so I went to a course, and I was like, wow, it was 5 days. And I was blown away because there was really, I don't know if there's maybe 30 of us there. And there's, I think, five faculty members. And it was just full on practicing and table training, you know, where you really were working on the craft of hand skills. And that was like called the Principles of Manual Medicine. And when I went there, I was like, okay, this is where I want to go. So I basically, you know, said, well, I want to go to grad school here so I can take all the courses while I'm there, you know, because there wasn't really a master's program in manual medicine or manual therapy, but there was the manual medicine group was under the College of Osteopathic Medicine in the division of biomechanics. So, you know, Phil Greenman and some of the other DOs were kind of in that biomechanics department. So that's basically how I said, well, I want to go where the people are. So I went there and was doing, you know, traditional kind of biomechanics kind of courses, but I kept, you know, every week would stop by Phil's office and try to say, hey, you know, is there anything going on? And can I do an independent study that this or that? And said, well, not right now. And, you know, I kept bothering him. And Mitchell said, hey, Tim, why don't you just come to clinic with me? And I'm like, you know, that was like to me the ultimate. I said, well, that's great. And so we basically did it. I did an independent study where I spent, you know, about 8 or 12 hours a week with him just in the clinic for a semester. Wow. And within about the first 2 weeks, you know, he showed me, he had me treating his patients first 2 weeks. Well, why don't you do that, Tim? And I was like, whoa, okay. and I rapidly, you know, like 3 weeks in, he says, oh, hey, there's this, you know, high velocity thrust course, and we need another table trainer. So why don't you help out, you know, in a couple of weeks in this course? Well, you have to look back at the time in the series was they had this principles and they had muscle energy and then the high velocity thrust course. And there's not that many PTs that had gone through that. And the thrust was always taught by the DOs. So they'd never been any PTs teaching it. And I didn't know any of this at the time. But Phil was truly one of those people that like to disrupt the status quo because he saw the future, what it was coming, and that, you know, really DOs were losing a lot of their manual kind of focus and PTs were really, you know, gravitating towards this. And, you know, he knew the role in the larger healthcare system that what was needed. And he just didn't want this craft or trade to be lost, I guess would be a good way to think of it. And so, yeah, so I was teaching in that course and he said, hey, you know, literally a day in, he says, oh, Tim, why don't you get up there and show them how to do this, you know? And again, I'm like, not really any prep, and you just kind of go with it. And I mean, I look back, and that really, I was just in the right place at the right time, I think, and it gave me opportunity to, you know, to not only teach, but to really get good at that. And I always said, you know, you never become an expert at manipulation, for instance, any manual skill, you're always learning. And I said, you know, I took the thrust course 15 times. I mean, I took it once as a student and I taught it 14 times, but you know, every time I went, I was learning something, you know, I was just, you know, continuing to pick up little things and in the refined things to make it just better in my hands. So, you know, that, yeah, he was a giant of a mentor because he, on many levels, just, I learned clinically what great, what expertise looks like, and what we're reading about now is much the same. Really, it's not the hands. It is really the communication skills and the decision-making skills that these experts have. I mean, the minute you walked in, you felt comfortable with this person that you're like, man, I wish he was my doc. You know, he just had that way of making people comfortable and getting to the heart of the matter very quickly. And then the second thing was you also learned that, you know, you don't need to have hundreds of techniques. And it was kind of funny because we do all these techniques in these thrust courses. And when I in clinic, you know, he would, you know, he mainly did 5 or 6, which kind of his bread and butter. And then he, you know, would pull out a couple of these other ones here and there. But it wasn't about the techniques. I mean, you know, you don't need that many techniques. You need to know when to use things and how to titrate it and how to couple that with the overall management of the patient. So, you know, I picked that up. And then finally, I'd say I would pick up the, you know, just the opportunity. Great mentors put you in places that they believe you can, you'll excel at, even if you don't feel like you're going to excel at that.
Wow, I mean, that's great. I love hearing those type of things, because I was just going to ask you the same question of, so what separated a person like Phil Greenman from the rest of us? I mean, you perfectly segued into that, so thank you for that. One of the things I was curious about, though, as you're talking, and how intense of a program that had to have been, you know, for the manual medicine at Michigan State, was, you know, given that as a background and, you know, all the different things that you've learned over the years, has your approach or manual therapy approach approach is the word I'm looking for. Has that evolved over time in your daily practice from, you know, more of a heavier emphasis on biomechanics or muscle injury or manipulation to anything different than that?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for those that know me, I mean, I forget one time I was still in the military. We were doing CSM. I think it was one of the, lectures, and it was on, Chris Powers and I were on the panel together, and it was kind of one of those where you're supposed to create some controversy and make it a yin and yang. And so anyway, I didn't tell Chris what was coming, because I would have lost the edge of surprise. But basically my whole talk was called Confessions of a Recovering Biomechanist. And it was really, and, you know, I kind of went down and just kind of slammed, you know, biomechanics and because of the time, and it was, again, we believed that was going to be a lot bigger sauce than I think it's come to be. Again, don't hear me dissing the great research in understanding mechanisms, but this was really looking on the perspective of, you know, where research needed to be in terms of outcomes and where we are going from an evidence perspective, you know, so really saying we didn't have enough on the outcome side of life. So, but, you know, so that, I think that was probably more than 15 years ago, maybe that I gave that talk. But, you know, so even at that time, you know, the idea of manipulation really being so focused on biomechanics was changing. And I think when you look back, a lot of disagreements in PT space has been around models. And I think, you know, biomechanics is a great one where there's been disagreement, because it's so funny if you really just step back and to say, why would we use the joint as a frame of reference, right? I mean, basically you have biomechanics of all these. There's a lot more soft tissue, nervous tissue, connective tissue than there is joint space, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet our frame of reference is really the joint. And because we made we call some things joint manipulation, when in fact, you know, as this evidence is emerging, it's probably, yeah, the joint may move, but that's where mechanistic research has actually helped form or reformulate our mindset that, you know, well, the outcome and the patient response and improvement and pain changes may not have much, if anything, to do with the joint. You know, mm-hmm. And yet the joint may have made some noise and moved, but, you know, the mechanisms behind change aren't at the joint level. And I think that totally, you know, that kind of rocks your world a bit, because if you think about it, you know, there's still programs, I mean, that are very focused on that idea of, you know, that there's restriction and, you know, extension, right rotation, right side bending. And there very well may be an impairment there. But again, that is just a description of, you know, what we think is happening at that level. And so that's number one. That's really, that's evolved. You know, again, as you begin to see that research, even if it was really 20 years ago, began to question, well, can we feel it really that precisely? Mm-hmm. And then more recently in the last decade and a half or so, you know, well, what really is the mechanism underlying it? So that was number one in terms of my initial evolution. And then number two is really this idea of, you know, really not putting enough credence. That's not the right word. I'm not understanding how powerful my beliefs and just my confidence when I apply these things, how powerful that was on the patient's response. In other words, these non-specific things we often call, but you know, if I am confident and believe in what I'm doing, that will actually improve the outcome of a patient. And that kind of rocks your world a little bit, right? You know, you think that, you know, it's just because I've got these, the precision of my hands are so good and I'm imparting onto the patient this great stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, no, you know, I can have kind of maybe mediocre hands, but if I'm very confident and believe in what I'm doing, that patient may get equally better. And that's a bit of a, it makes you again pause and say, you know, what am I doing? How did I get here? And makes you really question, you know, some of the assumptions that you had. So with that, if I can continue, sure. it really makes me teach differently. And I really spend a lot of time on building students' confidence in their ability to perform techniques, that they can confidently do that. And the better, and that's where I often say, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, people, when I lay my hands on them, you know, say, well, that feels different. And that feeling is imparted to patients. There's no doubt. You know, patients say that. Yeah, well, yeah, this feels different. And that came about through years and years of practicing the craft, right? So you get expertise in that from practicing. And so I never want people to hear, well, yeah, just, you know, be confident and, you know, tell the patient positive stories and life is good. You know, that's again the pendulum swinging entirely the other way. And I often say the truth lies somewhere in between. The expert, you know, has great listening skills, very intuitive to what the patient is saying with their words, but also more importantly, what they're not saying, and with their micro expressions and their actions, what they're really telling you. So the expert is keenly aware of that. The expert, when they lay their hands on the shoulder, it is different. It's caring, compassionate, and there is a warmth and a contact. It's like, oh, this person has done this before. And the expert, when they're actually doing, whether it be exercise, manipulation, or some type of movement-based therapy, they're guiding the patient through this motion effortlessly, and the patient senses it. It's like it's effortless that they are kind of moving into this new range, if you will. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really how I've kind of come around. And that's changed how I've taught, because I don't teach mechanically much anymore. I teach enough that hopefully they can get an answer on a question right on a board exam, but really stepping away from mechanical teaching to more of feeling and understanding and thinking of it more as a whole body, that techniques are really whole body movements by the therapist. So if you do a great stand pivot transfer, you can do a great lumbar manipulation. You know, you don't stand differently. You don't move differently. You have this power and movement within your body that can transfer across any type of skill that you do as a physical therapist. And it really is getting back to what I often say, you know, the expert does the basics extremely well. You know, it's really those fundamentals is where you make the money.
Yeah, and I appreciate all the things you were saying. I've definitely noticed over the years, and other people have too, that you can take you can have a clinician who's mediocre. I mean, you could even say mediocre at best in terms of their hands-on skills, but because of their interaction with the patient, their confidence, and what they can instill in the patient, you know, that makes a huge difference too, and patients still get better. But
indeed,
one of the things too that I've kind of realized, well, my background is somewhat in biomechanics, and I feel like I have a halfway decent understanding of mechanics throughout the body in what movements are traditionally thought to occur. But as I kind of continue on in my career, I've noticed that the nervous system and kind of inhibition facilitation of different things creates as many restrictions as a joint problem. Mm-hmm. And being able to balance out those things allows you to be softer with your hands and kind of easier with your technique versus, you know, what you might think early on in your career about, oh, I've got to go in and I got to mobilize, I got to manipulate this joint or this that joint. And being able to really see the fruits of that with a less aggressive treatment to the patient.
Yeah, I often liked one of the DOs, Paul Kimberley was his name, and he described, his definition of manipulation was the noiseless, painless restoration of maximum function.
Huh. That's pretty good.
Yeah, and, you know, taking that to heart where, you know, really, you know, it should be, you know, it's not about us imparting our forces onto the patient. It really is about us guiding the patient's system to move better. And, you know, that there's no doubt that certain times, and probably the hip's such a great example, because hip OA, you know, you can really, reasonable evidence of that if you're going to treat it manually, you got to treat it aggressively. And sometimes if you combine the treatments of manual therapy and exercise, it's almost like you lose dosage on both sides, you know. So whatever you do in that condition, you need to get after it, you know, because it's just, you know, it's a big, big muscle system. Yep. And a big joint system. Yep. And that in high loads. So it's used to that, right? You're walking around. So if you, as a therapist, you're going to have to put some higher dosage on that most of the time. And I think, you know, those different areas, you know, do require different loads, et cetera, and forces to get them moving ideally and improve patient outcomes. So, but I'm with you in that, you know, I mean, the thing that I'm most excited, obviously, pain, you know, therapeutic pain education and therapeutics pain sciences and modern pain sciences. I mean, really, physical therapists are totally leading the way in this field. And I just, you know, hope that every therapist, you know, really embodies those principles. And, you know, it's a struggle. People say the words, but just like everything else, to really embody what, you know, the modern pain science has taught us about discomfort and how we respond. That is a game changer in terms of practice change. And we always say, you know, from a perspective now on our clinical practice here at Colorado in Motion, we have four clinics, and we also work in with business to business in the industrial health space. But, you know, we say, you know, what binds us, we all have hands-on skills, whether it's our PTs or OTs. You know, we always do hands-on care, for most patients it's appropriate for. Mm-hmm. Someone's too hot to handle, so to speak, it's probably you're not appropriate to put your hands on those folks, but most patients we do. But what we really have focused on is that our language across all of our providers is more consistent around pain, and that we're not creating myths and catastrophization and using bad words like herniation and disease and degeneration and, you know, all that stuff. You know, that's just, you know, we try to push that out of our language to the point of from the very first phone call and our front desk people being trained to, you know, how to respond when people are hurting, and just teaching them about pain so they're better at education patients from the moment they contact our practice. And that's been a game changer. I mean, it's brought us together, and it's made us more consistent in how we're providing care.
Great. Okay. One of the things I also wanted to try and get your opinion on real quick is I've heard about, you were talking about teaching and doing different things with entry-level DPTs. The South College in Tennessee, and even Baylor, I think I just saw, got accredited for a two-year program. But the kind of transition that you and others are spearheading a little bit to move from a longer duration entry-level DPT program to a two-year program, where even there's some distance learning in that. Can you speak about how you got involved with that?
Yeah,
I think it's a great idea, but I just kind of curious to hear your thoughts how it came about.
Yeah, that's actually, I mean, if I'll try to make this long story short, because sure. We really, at Evidence in Motion, another company I'm involved with, we didn't start with this idea of going and creating a two-year blended DPT model. It really came about from really our fellowship training and residency training that was initially manual therapy fellowship and orthopedic residence, and now it's spread across multiple specialty areas. But at the time, there remains a big push for residency, but there just was not enough sites, and there was mm-hmm. never going to be enough sites if we're going to do ones and twos throughout the country. When, even in, a class of 60 graduating in your local neighborhood, for instance, your local city, having 60 residencies or 30 that are taking two was not happening. And it was not going to happen because just the barriers of creating the curriculum, getting things up. So long story short, we really started this blended hybrid residency and fellowship where, you do what you can online. You can listen to lectures, podcasts, read articles, comment, do all that stuff you can do online, and then use the weekends for the secret sauce, the hands-on training happening in, during more intensive laboratory time, and then your mentorship time happening in the clinic. So that was really, how we started. And then we kept realizing that, boy, there's such a discrepancy in the students that were coming in, depending on what school they went to. There was really a big discrepancy on their basic fundamentals of, for instance, musculoskeletal care.
Oh, wow.
And so it became clear, like, wow, there's a difference here. So we really need to, look at getting better, terminal internships and terminal clinicals and get people more standardized as they come into residency. So we basically created this curriculum, an internship curriculum, which was covered, different areas of practice, and really just kind of the high hitting, key fundamentals that, all PTs we felt should know as they enter a new, start their job and enter into a residency, to kind of right size it. Well, we spent a lot of time, and then we said, okay, we want to partner with some universities to integrate that, and that we felt would incentivize folks then to kind of come into a residency. Well, it was met with a giant thud. People, the academics were not really interested and didn't really see that. And we're like, wow, okay, we know we're onto something here. But this, we did not expect we'd get a silence. And being an academic myself, I mean, I understand what's going on. But so long story short, we said, we need to just a partner with the university to try to, move this further upstream. In other words, get into entry-level education, professional-level education, so we can start implementing some of these strategies. So really, it was a kind of a 3 to 4 year journey of meeting with a variety of both public and private universities and getting sometimes partially down the aisle and then getting the door closed in our face and saying, okay, well, let's try another one. And finally, for a variety of reasons, South College in Knoxville took the risk and we partnered with an Evidence in Motion South College to launch this blended model. And, you know, of course, it took a lot of heat because people heard it as an online 2-year DPT, which is, you know, the farthest from the truth. But, you know, again, that's when anything's new, you often, there's misunderstandings. The blowback. And in fact, it was really nothing different than what we'd been doing for nearly 15 years. It was like, okay, do what you can online, and then the secret sauce is in the labs. Now, the difference in DPT education, it's you have, there's blended learning happening. A lot of classes throughout universities are doing this. So it wasn't that radical. What was radical was the entire curriculum. And so when we do labs, I mean, they're 2-week intensive immersion labs. I say it's like language school. You're living, breathing that content, you know. So it may be, you know, like if I'm teaching, say, the lumbopelvic hip, I mean, that's 6 days of you're just doing lumbopelvic hip, you know, and that's 8 to 9 hours a day and, you know, grilling and practicing. And what you rapidly found out was we have way more time in lab than any program I've ever taught in, because you just are not starting and stopping your lab. You have much better lab faculty because you get, you know, actual clinicians that can, they can spend 2 or 3 days at a time, but to do a 3-hour block here on Tuesday and 2 hours on Friday, that just, you don't get great clinicians that can, over a course of a semester, can be blocking their patient care schedule in a way that would allow that. So what we found was we rapidly were able to change the amount of time that we were doing with students in the lab. So that's kind of what we did. So we started South Baylor, and now 2 other institutions. That will be coming on board with that same model. And the flip side of that, or not the flip, the next downstream thing is really most of those students, in fact, you know, I think, I'm not sure the final numbers on the first graduating class, maybe 60 to 65% are rolling into residencies. They see the value because they're getting out a year early, and then they can take that third year and really focus on refinement and residency type training. So, which is really the ultimate, I think, you know, where we want to go, because we're committed as a profession to residency-based training, but we all know that you can't to spend 3 years at higher ed after 4 years of undergrad. The debt load is just unsustainable. And then say, well, yeah, I'm going to go into residency, and either I'm going to have to pay, or I'm going to have to take another salary cut. And I'm like, you know, my debt's rising, and that's where I do believe it's going to be a game changer. I think 10 years from now, we'll have seen most programs will have shrunk the time, and we'll have had more partnership ideas that get people out quicker and into a residency type of program in their final year.
Yeah, I really think that has a lot of value, because like you're saying, the amount of debt that's incurred in just grad school alone, you know, forget undergrad, but grad school versus how much, you know, new grads come out and they get paid is not sustainable, like you're saying. So it's kind of nice to see innovation, and, you know, like most innovation in different fields, it's usually not received well right off the bat, but over time it kind of grows and people see the value of it. So yeah, hopefully things can transition to different models like that.
Yeah, I remain very hopeful, because again, you can see bifurcation points. In fact, you know, I think the Washington Post, you know, had a good article yesterday. It was basically saying, you know, healthcare isn't our only ludicrously expensive industry. And basically, you know, they say all these points and everybody's thinking, oh, they're talking about healthcare, about, you know, this and that. And they say, no, we're talking about higher education. And it was written by the president of Purdue, I think, university. But it's totally unsustainable. It's education's in a bubble. And I think for our profession, we, you know, looking back, you know, I mean, I think we went to the DPT for the right reasons, for many of the right reasons, but some of the wrong reasons. You know, I do think we, at the same, if they had changed nothing, we were coming out with a professional doctorate at 2 years, and we should, in hindsight, not added time, should have just added the residency onto the end,
yeah,
so a paid residency onto the end. But
well, Tim, I know our time's getting a little short. If I could transition to a few different kind of more rapid fire questions for you, what are some of the things that, you know, because you get to mentor a lot of different students and younger clinicians, what are some of the things that you hope younger clinicians learn from you or take away from their time with you?
You know, that's a good question. I would say passion for the patients that we are able to work with.
Okay.
Curiosity. Humbleness, an open mind, and a commitment to always improve your skill set.
Wow, that's I think something all of us can aspire to throughout our entire career, not just as young clinicians. So good to hear. Now, if one of the things that, you know, I've gotten to speak with some people on our conversations, there are some clinicians who got to learn from Dr. James Ciriax himself, and one of them said, you know, if he could, he had said, if there's only one thing he could be remembered for, it would be differential diagnosis. So I try and ask people here that have done a lot within the profession, you know, if there's one or two things that you'd like to be remembered for or remembered of in the realm of, you know, manual PT, you know, what would you want it to be and why?
That our role is preventing harm in patients. That as manual therapists, we have an obligation to keep people with musculoskeletal complaints from making a bad situation worse. So that would be one thing. If in manual therapy, because that'd be probably a bigger picture of PT. In manual therapy, hopefully, one thing, willingness to change based on new evidence.
And so even if that, you know, is obviously a willingness to change, being resistant to new evidence that is contrary to what you're typically used to practicing.
Yeah, I mean, and think about, you know, there's a paper I wrote way back, I think in 2001, on the clinical prediction rules. And, you know, and it's still people are talking about it. And I guess it was good because it changed the conversation a bit. But looking back now, there's lots of flaws in that. And it led us down in pathways that we had to thought we were getting somewhere and then recalibrated. But you hope that it got the conversation started, and then it got us thinking differently about what really matters when we choose various procedures.
Okay. Now, moving on to just my next question. Over the years, what is some of either the best or the worst advice that you've heard being given to others? Or you could even say that's being given to yourself.
Oh, you got some tough questions here.
Yeah, sorry.
Let's see here. Well, you know, I think the best advice is really whatever you do, I do believe in more sustained learning. And that the best advice is there is a difference between taking a weekend course versus doing a residency, fellowship, or even a longer term certification program. You know, kind of that sustained commitment to learning about something. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's good advice, you know, even personally, you know, I've really kind of learning about pain sciences and really committing to get better and better at understanding this. And, you know, I think that that versus what you see, you know, and I get resumes a lot, and you just see this, you know, plethora of courses. So there's CE junkies, so to speak, but there's not been any fundamental understanding about application and clinical reasoning to how one would apply this. It's almost just jumping from, oh, this is cool, works, I do this for a month, and then boom, this is cool, and I'll do it for a month. And so I think that folks that do a more sustained work, whatever that field is, they really get a better fundamental understanding to how they stand as a clinician. And perhaps the worst, I'm not sure if I can think about, you know.
Oh, that's okay.
Worst advice.
That's okay. Now, if you could challenge other people in your profession to do something, be something, or change something, what would you challenge others to, and why?
You know, I guess I would say stop being scared about your current model. And I think it's going to be different. We got to embrace change. It's going to be different. You know, again, when you don't, it's easier when you don't have anything to lose, as Bob Dylan said, when you ain't got nothing, you ain't got nothing to lose. And it truly is easier, you know, as you get more, you get more comfortable in your profession, and you're whether you be a clinic owner, whether you be, you know, you're comfortable doing that, then it's harder to change. And, you know, I've been fortunate enough to be around people that forced me to change. And, that's now I don't think of it, but there, you know, looking back, there was time where, you know, I kind of felt really comfortable where I was at and was thinking, well, maybe I can just ride this out. You know, it's pretty comfortable. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then really having your world rocked by some data and stuff saying, you know, no, I can't. This is not being true or authentic to yourself. So that would be what I would say, you know, just really that willingness to change. And that means, you know, getting into different spaces that are outside PT and really spending more time outside of our own kind of profession.
Hmm. So you mean just collaborative environment with other professions?
Yeah, collaborative environment with other professions. I mean, personal growth, whether it be mindfulness, meditation, yoga, doing other things that are outside perhaps what you're normally doing, and being willing to do that and grow and learn from that.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's great advice, actually. I wasn't quite sure. That's why I wanted to clarify there. So good. Now, getting into a couple of other things, if given your years of experience, you know, in treating patients, if for a majority of people that, you know, come into your door that you end up treating, if you could only pick one region of the body or one body area that you would tend to work on for almost all patients, if that's the case, you know, what might it be? And you can use any type of techniques that you like.
Yeah. I mean, it would be the thoracic spine and rib cage. Yep. And it's not just because I wrote a book about it.
I was
going to
say, yeah,
about
you did write a book in the mid-90s about it.
Yeah, it's another funny story. But
it's a great book,
anyway,
by the way.
The reason is, again, now knowing, again, it's prevalence drift. I mainly see patients with persistent pain. So, again, it's because of, at the end of the day, breathing and dialing down the sympathetic nervous system is a game changer for the vast majority of patients. So if your thoracic spine or rib cage is not mobile, you cannot breathe. And so it's really that, to me, is a game changer, and it's a way you can get in and provide some, for most patients, some relief and being far away from perhaps what their main complaint is. So that's what I would say wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you there for sure. It's kind of amazing to see how many different things in the upper and lower quadrants can be affected by thoracic spine or rib cage dysfunction. and especially the breathing and the sympathetic nervous system, and how ramped up that gets with especially people in chronic pain.
And I would argue that, you know, even when there's not quote unquote dysfunction, you know, what it really is now, this idea of a whole body, and we're using our techniques more neurologically. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like breathing is a whole body system. So if we focus, you know, on the breathing system first, that, you know, there's just a lot of bang for the buck there.
Okay, good. Now, if a couple of just other questions, and then I'll try and let you go. But if you could only if you could only teach one thing to almost every patient that comes in your door, so just teaching one or two things, what might it be?
For sure is pain or discomfort is, you know, the body's telling you to pay attention, and is not necessarily a function of any damage going on. You know, pain does not equal damage.
Yeah.
And that'd be the number one thing and that I'd focus on.
Okay. And just to kind of educate them that not to get too overly fixated on sensations like that.
To
the point where they start making poor decisions, or at least decisions that we consider poor in the traditional medical model.
Yeah, I mean, that, because it goes along with the second thing I often say is never underestimate the power of the medical system to make you worse. I always say, you know, again, let's slow this down and let's try to understand what's going on. Totally validating this, what their experience is. Their experience is real. It's their experience. Mm-hmm. And our job is not to make their experience worse first. That's our first job. Let's not make this problem worse. And we have a good track record of making things worse. So let's kind of move on now. How can we make this better? And that really focuses on what is the one thing you would love to be doing next week? Be out of pain. No. We'll talk that. But what is the one thing? What gives you joy in your life? What aren't you doing that you need joy in your life for? And tell me what that is. So it's more, I would almost say, the one thing I do is more, would be more asking than telling.
Mm. Powerful words by Tim Flynn right there. Now, Tim, I usually try and give everybody an opportunity to speak about or mention anything that's on their mind. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention or bring up while we're wrapping up here?
Well, first of all, it's been a pleasure. I love to talk about this, and just I feel like we're on the cusp of a major movement where we've been trained and educated and practiced as physical therapists and manual physical therapists for this moment in time. And my call to action would be, yes, we get together at conferences such as AOMP, CSM, et cetera. We get together and that should nourish us. But if we're only talking amongst each other, we've literally failed to do what we're currently called to do, and that we should spend 95% of our time talking outside of our profession and 5% of time within. And of that 5%, maybe arguing about, you know, a half of a percent, and the other 4.5% of that, collaborating on how are we going to make this dysfunctional thing we call a healthcare system better for society.
Wow. Okay. I really like that thought, especially spending overwhelming majority of our time, you know, outside of our profession. It's really good. Okay. Well, Tim, if there's any way that listeners can learn more about you or learn more of what you're up to, I know you have podcasts and websites and you're teaching and doing many different things. how best can listeners learn more about you and what you're up to?
Yeah, great question. Thanks for the shout out on our podcast. Our podcast is actually called Pain Reframed. Mm-hmm. You can find that on iTunes or just Google that and find that. But that's really, I encourage anyone listening that's involved in treating pain to take a listen, and particularly listen to the episodes with from some of the orthopedic surgeons and episodes from really two of the Stanford professors talking about opioid addiction and how to get folks off, as yes. well as, you know, just how we got here, you know. Anna Lemke's drug dealer MD, and you know so I do think, you know, that's a good place. So Pain Reframed, you can, on Twitter I'm at Timothy W. Flynn, so at Timothy W. Flynn. I post a lot. I'm told that I'm not a great engager. I try to give information that's of some use out there, and I do communicate a bit, but you know, you can find me there. I'm involved with evidenceinmotion.com, and that's where more teaching and long programs, as well as South College DPT program. If you're in Colorado, Colorado in Motion, that's our physical therapy practices that we have. So all of those are ways you can find me. And if you're hearing this and run into me at CSM or AOMT or any other pain conference, say hello.
Great. Well, I'll be at CSM this year and the Academy meeting later this fall. So we'll definitely look forward to seeing you there.
Well, that sounds great, man. And again, thank you so much for the time. Really enjoyed speaking with you.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. I appreciate it. Hope to see you again soon, and have a good rest of your day. Hey, guys, just one more thing before you go. Wanted to ask again, if you don't mind, if you like what you hear, please give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Leave us a comment on the website. Let us know what you like and what you don't like. But also, follow us on Facebook or on Twitter. Share what you think, and please pass on our information to colleagues or other people around you that you think may benefit from what we're doing here. We appreciate you guys listening as always. Hope to hear from you soon, and until next time, thanks.